At Alma, we know the connection between you and your therapist matters. But if you're already feeling stressed and burnt out, the idea of trying to find a therapist you really connect with can be overwhelming. That's why Alma's focused on helping you find the right therapist for you. When you browse their online directory, you can filter by the qualities that are most important to you. Then, book free 15-minute consultations with any therapist you're interested in seeing. And because 95% of therapists at Alma accept insurance, you can find care that's affordable too. You want to talk to someone, but not just anyone. Alma is there to help you find the right fit. Visit helloalma.com/therapy30 to schedule a free consultation today. That's helloalma.com/therapy30.
Talk is Jericho, baby. Talk is Jericho.
All right, welcome to Talk is Jericho. It's the Pod of Thunder and Rock and Roll, and it's Friday. And today, I've got one of the most famous, biggest names, and also, oh yeah, one of the nicest guys in show business here on Talk is Jericho. He actually might even be one of the nicest guys I've ever met, period. I'm talking about Shep Gordon. That's why they call him Supermensch. If you look up Mensch in a Jewish dictionary, it means a great guy. He is a super great guy, and he really, really is. He's been Alice Cooper's manager for 45 years. He knows everything about show business. He's also managed, get this, Raquel Welch, Luther Vandross, Blondie, Teddy Pendergrass, Burton Cummings. He worked with John Lennon and Yoko Ono. He met Jimi Hendrix and Janis Joplin on his first day in L.A. He's got some amazing stories, which he'll share with you today. He's also got a new autobiography that just came out this week. They Call Me Supermensch, which is kind of a companion piece for the amazing Mike Myers documentary called Supermensch. This is the most popular guy you've never heard of. Check out They Call Me Supermensch on Amazon. Use those Talk is Jericho links if you do. Like I said, that fantastic documentary Supermensch is also up there. Supermensch, the legend of Shep Gordon, put together by Mike Myers. You got to check it out. It's also on Netflix, or you can get it on Amazon. This is how great Shep Gordon is. I met him at the Clive Davis Grammy party last February. We sat together at the same table, and then my family and I stayed with him at his place in Maui over the summer. After sitting with him for an hour, he invited me to stay with my family in Maui. Had a great time and recorded this podcast while I was sitting in his beautiful, beautiful house. You're going to hear the incredible stories of rock and roll legend Shep Gordon. Okay, so we're here at this palatial, beautiful home in Maui of Shep Gordon. And it's really funny because our first meeting was a classic.
One of the classics of all time.
Right?
Yeah.
Classic. I get invited to go to Clive Davis's Grammy party with a mutual friend, Paul Stanley, and everybody is there. Like, you know,
everybody. Every face.
Ringo Starr is there, yeah. And like Nancy Pelosi is there, like
everybody.
But they stick all the rockers in the back at the same table.
And all basically AA.
Yeah.
We're the only drinkers.
We're the only drinkers at the table.
It's everybody else's diet kept Pepsis. And
yeah, it's Paul Stanley, Gene Simmons, Alice Cooper's there, Chad from Nickelback.
Yeah.
And you and I end up sitting next to each other. Mm-hmm. And we decide that we want to have some drinks. But I think the bar was closed.
Yeah, they made it. I think, as I remember, they made an announcement that once the music started, you couldn't get any more drinks.
Right.
And this was right at the edge of the music starting. So I think you waved over, I waved over. Some really nice older Mexican waiter came over and he brought us some drinks. And you tipped him very handsomely.
Yeah.
And that started the night.
And then he just kept bringing drinks over, whether we wanted them or not. He said, you want some more drinks, boss? Here's some more drinks, boss. So Shep and I have literally, I think, about 8 to 10 drinks each in front of us. I started getting embarrassed.
Yeah, at a table of all non-drinkers, yeah. Like ex-alcoholics.
Yeah, I'm looking at Paul Stanley going, I really didn't order this many drinks. But the guy just loved us. He kept calling us boss. Here you go, boss.
Yeah, it was very much like a Monty Python routine or something, you know, or a David... I can't think of his name, but yeah, it was like so absurd.
Was that a Seinfeld or a Larry David?
Larry David.
There you go. That's right.
Perfect Larry David.
But the funny thing about it is that you and I sat next to each other and just hit it off right off the bat, which is really cool because, as you know, being in this business for such a long time, sometimes you just get a vibe with somebody and instantly just hit it off. And that's kind of what happened with
us. I had been to a couple of Golden God Awards where you host. I think they were Golden God.
Yes.
Where you hosted, and I was really impressed.
Mm.
We didn't get a chance to say hello.
Yeah.
But I thought, wow, what a great, that's so great that it, You know, could be so comfortable in both worlds, handle both worlds. They're really, in a way, the same world.
Mm-hmm.
In most of the performing arts, it's really the same world. If you're a chef, you may walk in dungarees, put on your whites, and come out of the kitchen. If you're Alice, you may come in dungarees and then put on your stuff. And, you know, for you, same thing. You go, you put on your costume, you come out.
Put on your suit of armor.
Yeah. So it was really, I was impressed. So I was happy, really happy to meet you.
Yeah, me too.
And I'm a wrestling fan.
See, I didn't even know that either, because obviously I watched your amazing movie Supermensch and had seen like how much stuff you're actually into, and it's amazing. We'll go through your house here. Is like, there's so much cool stuff. I've been walking around looking at all the gold records on the wall and the pictures and everything.
The battle scars.
But I didn't know that you were a wrestling fan.
Yeah, as a kid, my dad and I used to watch the Haystacks Calhouns.
Okay.
And Antonina Rocca. Loved those. And for my birthday, once in a while, he'd take me to Madison Square Garden to watch a match.
Right.
I just thought it was the coolest thing. And then when I started to get into the music business, I ended up with one of my first acts was Blondie.
Mm-hmm.
And the lead singer, Debra Harry, was a huge wrestling fan.
Really?
So we used to go to the Garden all the time for shows. And then later on in life, I got very friendly with Cyndi Lauper, who was a huge wrestling fan. And sort of got peripherally involved a little bit. And then Alice wrestled with Jake the Snake at WrestleMania, I think, 3.
Famous story. He was the second for Jake the Snake at WrestleMania 3 in the Pontiac Silverdome.
And the next day, I went to a Sugar Ray, I think, pretty sure it was Sugar Ray Leonard boxing match outdoors at Caesar's Palace. And the WrestleMania was so much more exciting, and I'm a huge boxing fan. And it just blew my mind. So I've always been
more of a vibe at the wrestling show than it was the boxing show.
For me, it's always about the audience.
Mm-hmm.
And the audience was so much more engaged at WrestleMania than it was ear deafening. I mean, like deafening, the boos and the screams and the, and the fight was exciting. But it was just another event.
Yeah, sure.
You know,
sure.
These were people at the WrestleMania, people went out of their bodies. They were just nuts.
It was, at the time, the biggest wrestling show of all time.
It was nuts.
93,000 people.
Completely nuts.
How did Alice get involved in that? Because I remember as a kid being a rock and roll fan and being an Alice Cooper fan, I just thought it was the coolest thing that he was there.
I don't remember the connection, but I think it may have been because of Debbie or because of Cyndi. Somehow I got to meet Vince, and I was always looking for crazy stuff for Alice to do, and he used a snake in his show.
Right.
And Jake the Snake, it just seemed obvious.
Perfect,
And they said, oh, yeah, we're doing this big one. And I think Ozzy Osbourne may have been
Ozzy's
there that
with the
day.
British Bulldogs as well, yeah.
So it just said it was perfect. I said, Dallas, you're going to be wrestling with Jake the Snake. Luckily, he was an alcoholic because he wasn't wise enough to say, are you out of your mind?
But you just said that you're always looking for something crazy for Alice to do, because we talked about this earlier. There's a few managers that started with their guys and have been there the whole career. Yeah. Rod Smallwood and Iron Maiden, Ray Daniels and Rush, and Shep Gordon and Alice Cooper. You guys started basically together at the same time.
45th year, maybe more.
Was he already a band when you got connected with him?
Yeah, they were a band from Phoenix. They had just changed their name to Alice Cooper. They were the Naz.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a band with Todd Rundgren in it called the Naz.
Okay.
So they gave it up, and it just changed their name. They had had success in Phoenix as the Spiders. They started as the Earwigs. They actually started as a stunt. They were all runners. And when the letter dinner came, they had to do a stunt. You know, in high school, the letter dinner. So they decided to be a band. And they got wigs and plastic instruments.
Guitarist, really?
And played music, and they loved it. Alice said he loved the girls were like, you know, he loved it. So they...
Because originally the band was called Alice Cooper.
Later on. So they started as the Earwigs. Then they changed a few members, became the Spiders, and started playing locally in Phoenix.
Mm-hmm.
Had a top 10 record in Phoenix. And like every band in those days, you had to get to L.A., to make it.
Mm-hmm.
It was the L.A. scene days. Maybe New York, but L.A. was the place. So every top band from every state and city would merge on L.A. and try and get to play the Whiskey, or try and get to play Venice, or it was a great place on Sunset.
The Troubadour?
Troubadour too, but for the rock and rollers.
The Gazzaris?
Gazzaris.
There you go,
So he came. They came to L.A. for that. They had no money, weren't successful, and a friend introduced them to the Chambers Brothers, who let him sleep in their basement.
No kidding.
And that's where I met the Chambers Brothers, who said, "You Jewish? You should be a manager. We got these guys living in our basement." They went to Alice and said, "We found a Jew that'll manage it." You got to have a Jewish manager.
You know, it's quickly funny. I went to, used to go to this place. It was called Mel's. Is somewhere
Mel's yeah. Diner?
Yeah, yeah somewhere yeah. close on yeah. close to Hollywood and Hollywood 101. And there used to be this old black dude eating pie all the time, and he looked like a rocker. Like, you could just tell. And I went and talked to him one time, and it was, I can't remember which one, it was one of the Chambers Brothers.
Yeah, yeah. Great guys.
Used to hang out with them all the time, have coffee and some
the
pie.
Greatest
two
guys. I stay in touch with Lester and his kid.
I think,
but I know I would not be here without them.
So they connected you with Alice because you're a Jewish guy.
Yeah.
Was Alice your first protege?
Alice is my first act. Yeah.
So what did you do? Like, okay.
You know, for me, the way it actually came down is, and this is, I don't say this because I want other people to follow, but I checked into a hotel and I was dealing drugs, and Chambers Brothers were a client. And the conversation came up. I think it was Jimi Hendrix, who was another guy staying there, who said, "What are you going to do if the police ask you where do you get your money to stay in this hotel and have a car?" And as a white Jewish kid, that wasn't anything on the table. Nobody ever asked me where you got. He said, "You know, where I come from, if you wear a new watch, the cop on the beat will say, where'd you get the money for the watch?"
Oh.
So you need a front. You're Jewish, you should be a manager. "Hey, Lester, don't you have these kids from Phoenix in your basement?" Said, "Yeah, oh, yeah. So he went to them and he said, "I got a Jew who manages you and he'll give you $10 a week to say he manages it." So they were a cover. I never was going to take it seriously.
So this is like when you first moved into L.A.
This
you
is
went
when
to this
I
hotel
in LA,
to sell
yeah.
drugs. Gotcha.
Yeah, I went as a probation officer.
Okay.
Lasted one day. I was a long hair. It was the Reagan era.
Yeah.
I was an acid head, long hair, who was going to save the world.
Uh-huh.
You know, really help these kids out. And I realized the first day that wasn't going to happen. And checked into a motel and ran into all these guys.
You ran into Hendrix at the hotel?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I ran into the first night. It was a girl screaming at the pool around midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning. And I had just come from a jail, Los Padrinos Juvenile Hall. That's where I worked for that one day as a probation officer. So in my brain, I was thinking rape. I don't know why, because rape wasn't part of my life.
Mm-hmm.
So I ran down to the pool and I separated these two people. And the girl punched me because they were making love. She wasn't getting raped. And when I went out of the pool in the morning, it was Janis Joplin.
Are you kidding me?
No. So she introduced me to Lester and all the guys, and then they became clients, you know.
Yeah.
It was perfect. And then maybe a month into the staying at the motel and selling stuff to everybody, this idea of you need a front, you need something.
Right, yeah.
If, you know, police ask you where you get the money, you can say you're a manager.
Mm-hmm.
I manage this band. But then, so that was the basis of our relationship for the first probably 4 or 5 months we were together.
With Alice.
Yeah. Yeah. And then people started getting arrested all around me. People I got from, some people I just was getting
busted.
Yeah, getting really close. And I didn't want to do it anymore, so I had nothing else in my life. Alice came over and I told him what happened. You know, I said, "I don't want to do this anymore." No band, when I say Alice, the band.
Yeah.
The band was Alice.
Five guys, yeah.
And I said, "Listen, I've always been able to make money. I'm pretty smart. I think we can figure this thing out. If you guys want to give a shot, I will dedicate my life if you guys will. Let's do this till either we bust or we're millionaires." And we all shook hands and started to try and learn our crafts. You know, they started to try and learn how to really write and do stuff. And I just...
So what was your game plan? Okay,
we had no game plan at all. But as we started to talk, I went to see them play. They were horrible, in my opinion. Not that I'm a brilliant music man. Mm. I don't claim that. But to me, they were horrible. And everybody walked out of the building, so everybody sort of had the same feeling. And I had gone between college and probation officer. I had gone to 4 months of graduate school at the New School for Social Research, and one of the professors had given a talk about in the world of art, taste is very narrow. So for painters, for musicians, the audience is narrow. But if an artist can catch the wave of social change or catch the trends that happen, for example, what his examples were, Elvis Presley couldn't show his hips on the Ed Sullivan Show. Every parent said to their kid, you can't watch it. You tell a kid what they can't do, every kid goes through a period of rebellion. So if you can catch, if your art, like the Beatles, who were long hairs, like the Rolling Stones, who pissed on gas stations, if you can appeal to the kids, but the main thing is piss off the parents enough to say, you better not, you know, you may not hold those kids forever, but you get their attention.
Right.
So I told Alice and the band about this lecture I had, and I said, I think it's going to be easier for us to piss parents off than to make hit records, and we all know how to do that. So that was the basis that we generated everything, was what do we do that really piss parents off?
Because if you're dealing with late 60s, early 70s, just the fact that eventually when Alice became
a girl,
Alice,
yeah.
a guy with a girl's name.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. That was heresy.
Which was one of the things that made us do that, to hit that point. So all our stuff had a filter, and still does to today, although now it's more comic book than then. You know, then it was, nobody really knew if it was real or not real. You know, it was did he really chop, you know, chop up a
page? What were some of the ideas? Like, where did the idea come from for the guillotine on stage?
Or? Just that it was disgusting and chop his head off and, you know, let... I think when I look, it's funny, when I look back in retrospect, basically what we did, and I had this revelation. I went to Thailand and I got taken to a village 20 years after we were successful. And the village did a play for me, and it was exactly Alice's show, which was so weird. And basically what every tribal society has are these morality plays that they... It's how they teach their kids. And the morality play is always the same. It's a member of the community, Alice, a member of the community, he's a person, gets really evil, does horrible stuff. In the case of this Thai dance troupe, they raped and pillaged the wives of other people. For us, we did stuff like chop up baby dolls, do all these despicable crimes to society. He'd spit on people in the front of the audience. He'd, you know, stab things, and always dressed in black, which is the same in the tribal dances. Always dark, evil, black. And then the town would rise up, both in the ethnic plays and in our show. In our show, it was the band who would rise up, and they would take him and kill him for his acts that he did to society. He would be reborn again in white. Bubbles, things, boom, reborn, a rebirth, which is part of
every... That's exactly what the show was.
And that's what the show was. We didn't... I don't think we realized it until years into it. Because if we had realized, it would have been easier to write the shows. But they always had that same form. It was only when I went to Thailand, I called up Alice. I said, holy shit, we're not doing anything new. This is the oldest thing on the planet.
Yeah.
Holy shit, like, wow. It was an amazing revelation to see that, you know...
Sure.
We knew it was morality plays, but so things like the how do you kill them? So we tried to figure what were the most dramatic, disgusting ways to kill them. You know, if you guillotine them, you can hold up the head with the blood dripping. Every parent will hate that, you know, and you get the kids. So that was really our filter.
Did you have to go to a magician to find out
how to do
that?
Yeah, we got a lot of our things were built by Warner Brothers Film Studios. Then we, through this magician, Amazing Randy, we got to Harry Blackstone's stash. So the original guillotine was actually the Harry Blackstone's guillotine act.
Who's a famous magician?
Very famous magician out of Chicago. One of the most famous ever.
Wow, so it was his actual gag.
It was his actual guillotine that we found. It was waterlogged. We had to rebuild it, but we were all really proud of it. So pretty wild, you know. I think one of the best lines was... The first thing we did was hang him, and that was a Warner Brothers stunt. It was a hook on a harness on the back, and they built the gallows for us. And Groucho Marx came to see Alice's show, and when the show was over, Alice said, "How'd you like it?" He said, "Liked it, but I saw the gala routine in Chicago, 42. There's nothing new.
Yeah, nothing new, right?
It's
nothing
just
new.
How you use it.
Okay, we're sitting here with Shep Gordon, and when did you realize that Alice Cooper was getting so popular?
I don't know if we ever, I don't know if there was ever that one moment. You also have to remember that it was a completely different time. Mm-hmm. So part of realizing you're successful is having economic security. And that just didn't happen in those days. Alice headlined Madison Square Garden, sold it out. Top ticket was $2.50.
Wow. That's unbelievable.
$2.50. I have the poster inside.
So the
whole gross is $40,000.
Right, for 18,000 people.
We got, I think, $7,500, which was a lot of money in those days. But nobody had,
But you also got to put that back into
where
the
we made
show.
Money was on records, different than today. Because if you sold a couple of million records, which we did, you got a couple of million dollars. So we made money there. But that money gets dissipated and spent. You buy a car. None of the guys had cars. Everybody gets a car. You buy a few clothes. You get health insurance. So we were always hustling. And we hadn't, at the time that the group separated, we hadn't reached our goal of all having $1 million, which was our goal. I think if we had gotten to there, we probably all would have taken a deep breath.
So how is it for you as the manager when you see this band and you know that they're going on the upswing and they can't hold it together and they break up? Are you trying to hold them together?
Yeah, it was horrible. It was horrible, really horrible. Mm-hmm. On many reasons, Personally, I felt betrayed. Mm. I worked really hard, gave every ounce of my life to this thing, had some, had plenty of opportunities to do other stuff that would have been remunerated me, and I had given my word, I had shook my hands, that was all I was doing until we were millionaires.
Right.
And that if I did anything else, it would only be to help them, things like the Toronto Pop Festival, I gave up my whole fee to get them on the show with John Lennon and everyone, because that was what I promised.
The Toronto Pop Festival?
Yeah, it was the first Alice at a show with John Lennon. It's where the famous chicken. Right.
Explain that quickly.
That was
because everyone knows that story.
Yeah, it was completely random. It was really, it wasn't 100% random. We had worked into the show probably a year before when Alice came back out in white and the bubbles were flying. We were trying to think of what we could do that would be visually exciting. And we had no money. But the hotels, a lot of the hotels in those days had feather pillows. And they all had CO2 tanks as fire extinguishers. So one night I was at a feather. I said, Alice, let's take the feather pillow. And the CO2 tank doesn't cost us anything. And when you're going crazy on School's Out, we can, take the feathers and have a guy on the side of the stage blow the CO2. And in the lights, it'll be fantastic. It'll look like a Hell's a Poppin' scene or some crazy, And it worked. It was great. So we did it every night.
Mm-hmm.
So when we got to Toronto Pop Festival, we were backstage. And there was feral chicken, wild chicken.
Wild chicken, yeah.
And I saw the chicken, and I said, oh, my God, what a perfect thing when he's doing the feathers. If I throw a chicken up on stage, he'll probably throw it out to the audience. It'll be great. We all thought it could fly. But then it would be very cool and get some press, and we're on with John Lennon, so I'm looking for something.
So you wrangled them on the show to play.
They came to me to promote the show.
Gotcha.
They offered me a third of the profits, and I said, I don't want anything. I just want my act to go on between the doors and John Lennon.
Wow. Which is huge.
And they couldn't do the show sort of without me.
Yeah.
They didn't have the expertise. So, and they thought I did. I didn't really, but I bluffed my way through. And Alice went, we backed up Gene Vincent. They were the backup band for Gene Vincent on the show.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
Who's one of the great rock and rollers.
For sure. Bebopalula.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Like one of the really early greats.
Yeah.
So they backed him up, and then they played Between the Doors and John Lennon. And I remember Yoko's face when the chicken got ripped apart by the audience. Oh, my God.
So you threw the chicken on stage?
I threw the chicken on stage. Alice saw the chicken. He threw it out at the audience. The audience ripped it apart. Just ripped it apart.
Yoko didn't like that?
Didn't like that at all. Yeah, she wasn't happy with that, I don't think. But it got it. The next day, instead of saying that he threw the chicken out, it said that Alice bit the head off the chicken and mutilated it, which was the greatest thing they could ever do for us. Because it got every parent saying, this is the most disgusting guy in the world. You better not like him. And every kid snuck out of the house to go see him.
It was on it right there. So when Alice's band finally broke up, did you stay on just with Alice? Yeah. Did Alice continue on instantly, or was there some time?
Instantly. There was nothing else. You know, they were at the top of the – they were the biggest. 1972, the Alice Cooper Tour is the biggest tour in the history of rock and roll up till then.
Wow.
There's a great book, actually, called What I Do in the Back of the Limousine or something. It's about the three biggest tours of 72, which was Zeppelin, Alice, and The Who.
Wow.
It was a great years. And the guys wanted to do solo stuff. They felt, I think, that they were very compromised by having to wear the uniforms every night, do the theatrics. They wanted people to respect them as players, which I understood. My point was, hey, we made a deal. We made a deal. Mm-hmm. Like, we're not there yet. We're winning, but we didn't get there yet. We made a deal. Let's get to where we agreed to go to. And they said, no, but we'll come back in a year. And I was very vocal. I said, you're not getting me back. Mm-hmm. You know, we break a deal, I'm like, why would I come back?
Right.
For what reason? Don't know about Alice, can't speak for him, but mm-hmm. I worked too hard to come back and get, you know, do it again. But it was friendly, and we were all friends, by the way. We never had one bad second. I can't speak for them, but I assume from, you know, our relationships that I'm sure there's some anger. I'm sure there's some jealousy and some resentment. Mm-hmm. I think it's hard not to. You know, Alice's rocket ship took off so hard.
Yeah.
And we're very sympathetic to it. I just saw Neil Smith, the drummer. Just came to the show at Foxwoods, mm-hmm. And I was thrilled. I mean, like, really thrilled to see him. We all went through the wars together, you know, and never had a bad word.
Was it cool when you guys did the reunion at the Golden Gods?
That was the first time.
Yeah.
That was the first time.
Pretty much the only time. I think they do a couple shows afterwards, maybe.
We did one show afterwards.
Yeah.
Yeah. But we're talking now. I think in September, Alice has a break. They're going to record a couple of songs together, see how that goes.
That's cool.
And then they may go out and do some stuff.
Does it ever blow your mind as a manager when you see, let's for example, the Alice Cooper band, and they're, like you said, they're winning. They're on the course to becoming even bigger and bigger. But then the guys in the band step on their own tails of, like, because that happens all the time.
In everything. I'm sure, like, in wrestling there's plenty of guys who are about to be stars.
What gets you to the dance and then suddenly you don't want to do that anymore?
Yeah. Well, I think fame and success and all that stuff are the hardest things in the world to deal with. Really tough to deal with. Very few survivors. I mean, people I love, I encourage not to get on that roadway, because mm-hmm. once you're on it, it's hard to get off it.
Yeah.
And, you know, to win, you have to be rejected so many times.
Yes.
And rejection is just a tough thing. And then by the time you get there, you don't know why you're there, because everybody's rejected you.
You almost lose a little bit of the joy of making it, because you've been shut, you know, cut at so many times. You have to have super thick skin, so it's hard to enjoy.
To enjoy it. No, exactly. You know? I'm very sympathetic. And having now done this documentary, I see a little bit. I can see it. I have nothing close to any of them, but even the little bit of fame that I've gotten from it and notoriety, I could see how it's, you know, it could change, particularly if I was still at the point in my life where I had accomplished something.
Right.
It could really get in the way.
Because you were very well known within the business, but like you mentioned, now that the documentary comes out, the average person is learning who you are.
Yeah, it's wild.
Did you notice that right off the bat when it came out?
It was really fast. It's not often, but it was fast. I was in New York. I had a really interesting moment in New York. They were showing the movie at Tribeca Film Festival, and Michael Douglas was interviewing me that night. It was one of the first times they showed the movie. And I multitask. I love multitask. I love walking and thinking about stuff. I love being in my jacuzzi and thinking about stuff. I'm a loner who does my most effective work when I'm doing something else and I can think. So when I'm in New York, I may walk 7-8 miles a day. Mm. I love it. I walk everywhere. And the stuff that comes out of my head and gets cleared up. And nobody ever bothers me. So I was walking to the Tribeca Film Festival, and I heard, Mr. Gordon. And I turned around, and it was this middle-aged lady came over, and I could see You know, she was a little nervous. She said, I work at CNN. I just saw your documentary yesterday. They screened it. Can I talk to you for a minute? I said, sure. And she said that growing up, she had had a difficult childhood. And she really appreciated the way that I overcame my childhood. And would I mind talking to her a little bit about how I did it? And because she's having some troubles. And my inclination is to hug her and help her. But I look at my clock and I have an interview live on stage that I have to get to. So I can't help her, which is completely out of my nature.
Right.
So now I see what is important to me lost in that moment for something that isn't important to me.
Right.
So when I got to the event, Michael, I said, before you ask me these questions, I got to ask you this question. And I said the story. You know, I said, that's one person. I've traveled with you for 20 years. I'm the guy who puts the arm up to stop that person from talking to you. So I know how many want to get through you. Mm-hmm. And I said, and I know there have been plenty of times that I've put that hand up and there's been people in wheelchairs or on crutches or obviously challenged. How do you deal with not helping them?
Mm-hmm.
How do you deal with that as a way of life?
Right.
And he said it was really tough in the beginning, and he's become calloused. And it's a sacrifice he does for his profession, but not one that he's happy about. And the sad part is it's gotten easier over the years.
It's what we talked about earlier, that being on the road to fame, being famous.
Yeah.
It does change.
It's pretty wild. You have to really, you can't help everybody.
Right.
You can't be nice to everybody. You can't give time to everybody. And you lose your own journey in life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're on everybody else's path.
Right.
Instead of yours. I'm sure you go through it all the time. And it's as meaningless as it may be to the artist. I'm sure people come up to you and say, oh man, I saw you in 82. I was with my father. Do you remember? I was wearing a green shirt. I was in the third row. I jumped up. You sort of looked at me.
Yeah.
And that's important to them.
Sure.
And it's important for you to allow that to breathe at the same time.
Yeah.
How many do you go through every day?
But it's something that Ronnie James Dio told me. And I'm sure you met Dio over the years.
Yeah,
super nice. Another mensch.
Yeah, another
guy. Who told me, and that's what mensch means. If you don't know, I had to look it up. Mensch means a really good guy. Shep is a super mensch. It was actually Paul Stanley's book. He called Bruce Kulick a mensch.
Did he?
And I was like, what does that mean? I had to look it up. But Dio said, always give people their moment. If someone wants to say hi or wants an autograph, spend the 5 seconds and give it to them, especially if it's at the gig, because
it's the most selfish thing you can do.
Right. Yeah. You'll never remember it, but they'll never forget it.
They'll never forget it, and you'll have a good feeling.
Yeah. The most selfless thing you can do, right? Yeah. So when you're talking about Alice, and you mentioned you wouldn't do anything until the band broke up, then suddenly there's so many acts that you're associated with. Just looking at the wall, like I said, there's...
Yeah, because then I was free.
You were free to take all the offers.
Which is what I told him that night. I said, you know, if you want to let me out of prison, I'm not coming back to prison.
Mm-hmm.
I created the prison. I'm happy to live in it.
Was there a lineup of people wanting to work with you?
There was, but I never... I had a strange career. It was very rare that I started with anyone new after Alice.
How do you mean? Starting with a new artist?
Yeah, I was very lucky. As acts would get to number one, they would call.
Oh.
So I was able to cherry pick. Blondie called me when they had a number one record.
So why would they call you after they have a number one?
I think, A, because I didn't sign contracts.
Mm-hmm.
B, I had a reputation as a guy who could really add to a career.
Gotcha.
And I was cool.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't want to toot my own horn, but, you know, I got high. I was one of the guys.
Yeah.
It wasn't a lot of pressure. And I had a really good reputation for what I had done with Alice. Everybody thought that Alice had no chance to ever make it. You know, and then when I took Anne Murray, which was the first one I took when I got out of jail, and I made her work.
When I got out of jail.
Like, holy shit.
Why would you take Anne Murray of all?
She had a number one record called Snowbird.
Yeah.
And she was the furthest thing from Alice I could find. So I decided I needed to find out, was I actually good at this, or did I get lucky?
Good point.
Because if I just got lucky, commerce was never a problem for me. I could do other stuff. But if I was good at it, then I would pursue it.
Because Anne Murray in the mid-70s, I grew up in Canada, she was massive, massive star.
Massive.
Was she big in the States as well?
No.
Okay. Were you trying to get her big in the States?
I she had Snowbird, so people were interested.
Okay.
There was curiosity.
Right.
And it was then a manage, you know, to steer the right ship to get her through. But I always knew that it would, her end goal would have to be something like Vegas.
Mm.
It was never going to be Madison Square Garden.
Gotcha.
You know? But that was valid, too. There's a way to, you know, engineer a career for that.
Because she was super squeaky clean, too.
So squeaky clean.
Great story. Oh, please tell the story about when were you trying to get her some street cred? What were you trying to do? This is so great.
So one of the things that I realized with Alice, I called guilt by association, which was if you put a famous person next to someone else, the fame bleeds off. I used it with Alice all the time.
Mm-hmm.
There was, if you go back through the pictures with Dolly, pictures with Groucho, picture, we always, Liza Minnelli, anybody famous, we put him next to.
So by proxy, he's famous.
By proxy, yeah. He's famous. So with Annie, there was nobody who really cared about her. And I don't mean that in a bad way, but in the music world,
mm-hmm.
she was non-existent, especially to the rockers and to the people that mattered.
Mm-hmm.
She was this white bread thing who had a hit record and, you know, has nothing to do with
Canadian
anything
chick,
current, yeah. anything cool, anything. So I booked her into the Troubadour on Thanksgiving, which I thought was really ironic because she was Canadian, which is why I did it.
Sure.
And put this whole big show together. And it just so happened that the night of the show, all the guys from the Hollywood Vampires were at the Roxy. They had come early.
Now, the Hollywood Vampires was this gang of
with a drinking club.
Rock stars just got together and drank.
Just drank, got drunk.
Yeah.
And luckily for me, there was no Uber. And nobody could afford taxis. So I was sort of the designated driver. So I would come in late at night and drive whoever needed a ride home. I had a 54 Cadillac limousine. It was so uncool. So I realized they were all together. I don't remember how. Maybe I drove by or somebody told me they were all there. So I said, shit, let me go give this a crack. So I drove over maybe an hour and a half before the show. And I literally got down on my hands and knees. It was John Lennon, Harry Nilsson, Mickey Dolenz from the Monkees, and Alice were there. And I said, listen, I got this girl from Canada. She's so, but I manage her, and I want to be look like I know what I'm doing. If you guys would come over and take a picture with her, I'll pick you up every night and take you home when you're drunk. If not, you're on your own. So they all came with me for 5 minutes. They didn't see the show. He came in, took the picture. I don't think Annie wanted to take the picture. She was
against her principles at the time.
But she took it.
Yeah.
It hit everywhere. We got calls for Midnight Special for her to host Midnight Special.
And she was on Midnight Special from that, right?
Rolling Stone did a big piece on her. Everybody, because now she became the coolest chick
in the world. It worked, right. Yeah. She's the one chick hanging out with the Hollywood Vampires. All the chicks.
Got signed by the Riviera in Vegas right away.
Oh, so you got her there then?
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So all worked.
Did you ever hang out with the Hollywood Vampires at all? Did you ever?
A little bit. I was never a real drunk. I hung out with John quite a bit.
Really?
Yeah, because I wouldn't call him a friend at all. But when I did that festival, I developed a relationship with him and Yoko.
Mm-hmm.
I was very heavy at the time. I was about 250 pounds. Mm-hmm. And they got me to be macrobiotic.
Really?
And I lost 80 pounds, 70 pounds. I got down to a real weight.
No kidding.
I remember I got in the bathtub in Toronto the first day I got there. And I looked down and I couldn't see my dick. I don't know if I can say that on your show. But it completely freaked me out.
Yeah.
And I said it to Yoko when I was there. I said, I got freaked out this morning. I was in a bathtub and I actually couldn't see my, you know. And,
my schmeckle.
Yeah. And she took me to a restaurant in Toronto with macrobiotic. And then I would meet her in New York later on at a place, The Source. Well, not The Source. It was a great macrobiotic restaurant down. And you sat on your, down on the floor, you know, across your legs and one of those real hippie dippies.
Yeah.
But then they decided they wanted to do a couple of things. I was working with a guy named Rabbi Abraham Feinberg. When I say working with him, I needed him for the Toronto Pop Festival to do some political stuff we had to make. And he had done an album. So as a favor to him, I sold the album. And then John and Yoko wanted to do a bed-in. So that's who they did it with, was Rabbi Feinberg to promote the album. Remember the bed in
Toronto? Yeah, they would just hang out in bed all day.
That was with Rabbi Feinberg, yeah.
To promote Rabbi Feinberg's album.
Out of all this stuff, they then contacted me and a fellow named John Walker from Canada. who had promoted the first show. And they wanted to do a big free festival. I think they wanted free. But they needed to do a festival that could draw 100,000 people because spaceships were going to come down and land. And anyone who had a shaved head was going to be taken on the spaceship to Nirvana Land.
Oh, gotcha.
It's called Strawberry Fields was the festival. And they had a guy named Leonard who had very complex drawings of the spaceship. It was Sufis. And they really believed it. I mean,
John did too? Yeah, John Lennon.
This was them, John and Yoko. Really. It's when John shaved his head.
Right.
That's why he shaved it, was to get on the spaceship.
He was convinced that aliens were going to come.
They both shaved their heads, Yoko.
Oh, Yoko did too, yeah.
Remember when they shaved their heads?
Yes.
That's what they shaved it for.
You're kidding me.
Yeah. And we did the festival. But during that time, I got to spend a lot of time with them because they had blueprints and diagrams and safety issues. In the end, we drew the 100,000 people. The spaceships didn't come. And they said it was because there were too many non-believers. So okay. The spaceships turned away.
They turned away.
Yeah. But they truly believed it.
Was this a drug thing, do you feel, or just whatever they're into?
No. I never saw them as big druggies.
Hmm.
I mean, John smoked a little, maybe did a little too, but he was an alcoholic.
Yeah.
You know, Fred, I wouldn't call him an alcoholic. This was his drinking dark period.
Right.
But they weren't damaged at all.
Interesting. So if they would ever had that belief, is it a cultic type thing?
Yeah, it was weird. This guy Leonard was weird.
Gotcha.
Long red-haired guy with a ponytail. He was sort of this Bengali guy.
Did they ever ask you to manage them?
No. Never.
Not a thing. So of all the other, because you go through, did you manage non-musicians as well?
I managed Groucho Marx.
That's interesting.
Yeah, I didn't do much. He had no money.
Okay.
So I helped to get the TV show back on the air.
His finances in order.
Yeah, did an album with A&M.
Okay.
From Carnegie Hall. Raquel Welch.
Hmm.
Who was great. Actually, Raquel, I think, was even before Annie.
She might be the hottest girl ever.
Yeah, it was.
You could put her in the list.
It was, but a complete prude.
Really?
Which is really wild.
No kidding.
I love Raquel. I have an unbelievable amount of respect for her. She really lived her life for her kids.
Huh.
Complete respect for this woman. Raised two great kids and, but she called me up, and it was a blind call at the office, and was right after Alice's solo record. And the secretary said, Raquel Welch on the phone. I said, yeah, sure, Raquel Welch is on the phone. And I said, no, it sounds like Raquel Welch. Hi, are you that freak that made that guy Alice? Oh, no, are you the guy that made that freak Alice Cooper famous? And I said, yeah. I said, I'm picking you up tomorrow night. You're taking me to the Academy Awards.
Wow.
Holy shit. So she picked me up. I took her to the Academy Award. She was wearing this pink chiffon dress. And in those days, there wasn't a lot of media. But there was a guy named Johnny Grant who covered it for KTLA-TV.
Mm-hmm.
And he would come into the limousine as it pulled up. So the door would open in the limousine. Johnny Grant's head would go in. Hi, how are you?
He'd be the on-the-spot reporter. Okay. Yeah.
So as we get there, and I'm so nervous, I'm sweating out of every oar. My armpits are so sweaty, and my face is like dripping sweat. It's Raquel Welch.
Yeah.
I'm sitting next to Raquel Welch. Holy shit. And she turns with a big smile. She said, grab the back of my dress. The clasp just broke. I had this sweaty head. I'm like shaking, holding her dress to go in. I had a really funny, Bill Graham sent me a picture. It was a picture in Time magazine of Raquel and I walking in, and it says Raquel Welch, which unnamed escort. But she was she said, she was getting older. Sex stars don't do well when they're older.
In Hollywood, yeah. Yep,
she had these two kids to raise, and she needed to raise them. She wasn't getting any support, and she needed to reinvent herself and figure out a way to make a living. What did I think? And at that time, Ann Margaret was very successful in Vegas. She was very successful in Vegas. And I said, let's just take the Ann Margaret route. Let's just take two steps behind her.
Hmm.
You know? And that's what we did.
Did Raquel sing?
She ended up singing okay by rote. She learned everything by rote. She probably rehearsed 8-10 hours a day, vocal coaches.
Wow.
Hard worker, man. I've never been around a harder worker. Possessed. And no natural, and this is not nice to say, and I don't mean it the way it sounds. didn't have natural ability like someone who just takes to
but
something.
That's not a bad thing to say. She didn't have just, natural singing ability. That happens.
But she got it. I mean, she got it. The shows were great. Did a great job. Headlined the Riviera, I think it was, for many years.
So this is what you could do, is you would see what this person had to offer and how to reinvent themselves in a different genre.
Try and get it down to a couple of words. I use this example of what management, at least my kind of management, was. I had these two artists, Teddy Pendergrass, Luther Vandross, which appear to be the same
artist.
Very
similar.
Yeah, you would think are fairly similar. So how do I separate them and not compromise one or the other?
Mm-hmm.
With Teddy, the essence was sex. It was all about sex. It was focused heavily on women, and it was about the animal instincts of women.
Is that how you marketed him?
That was what I knew was the appeal.
Gotcha.
So how do you say that without saying it? How do you say that without being arrogant? How do you say that if you tell people that, they're not going to listen.
Mm-hmm.
So you need to deliver the message in a way that they tell someone. So what I did with him was for women-only shows. I only let women in. I did
really?
It in five major cities, the Greek Theater, Radio City Music Hall.
Did you sell them out?
Oh, yeah. Gave out chocolate teddy bear lollipops to lick during the show. So it got,
sticking
you know.
Sticking the tongues out, yeah.
And then when we went to do the ad, we said, it's still arrogant. Spend the night with me. Because that's what we called it, a spend the night with me tour. It's still fucking arrogant. But finally, somebody in my office in the art department came with this brilliant idea, which was Teddy's nickname was the Teddy Bear. So we did the cutest little stuffed teddy bear with a note on it that said, come spend the night with me, Teddy, instead of having a picture of him.
Right.
So it was soft.
Yeah.
But the event was all women.
Lust.
Yeah. So now, how do you separate that from Luther? Luther's romance. He's not about sex. He's about romance. Bottle of wine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Teddy's about grab you, take your panties off and
bang you, right.
So with Luther, what we did is we ran contests in 20 of the top markets in America. Get married by Luther on radio live.
That's great.
Romance.
Mm-hmm.
So it became this romantic, you know, if you're getting married, that's what you play. If you want to get ask your girl to get engaged, you play one of those songs. If you go into it, you're making a beautiful dinner for your man, you play one.
Mm-hmm.
And that was sort of what, as a manager, that's what I think is an important part of it, understanding who the audience, who your artist appeals to, and figuring out how to get to him in a really simple, direct way that tells them who he is without telling them who he is. And then you sort of know where to go with everything. You know, with Teddy, I knew where to go because I was always going to the groin. With Luther, I knew where to go because I was going to the heart.
Wow. What a perfect way to distinguish the two.
Yeah.
Because both of them, and once again, seeing the stuff on your wall, both massive, massive stars in their time frame,
yeah.
You know, selling out the Seven Nights at the Forum, Luther's over here and Teddy's over here. But yet both of them also passing away very young.
Very young.
Which is another thing, they're very connected in that way as well.
A big part of it. I've had way too many go young.
Yeah.
It's a hard, the fame is tough to deal with.
That's what I mean. Like, if you're talking about Teddy, I think he had that car crash where he ended up being very injured.
But he had two or three car crashes that week.
So you know that he's obviously partying or whatever it is.
Oh, yeah.
Are you telling him, dude, slow down, or does he want to even hear it? Or?
I probably wasn't in his case. In Alice's case, I was, because Teddy never got to the point where it affected. I mean, it killed him,
mm-hmm.
but it didn't affect his day-to-day routine. He was a pretty happy guy. He wasn't late too often. You know, he was pretty responsible, did his job, took care of his kids, took care of his mother, lived with him. He was a functioning human being.
Mm-hmm.
And we both were party animals. And we both went way over the line.
Right.
You know, abused it way over the line.
This was the 70s or 80s?
Yeah, this was the 70s.
And that's kind of the way it was back in the
70s,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that's how I signed them, was getting higher than him.
I mean, how do you do? What did you do?
I went to him and I said, I was asked to go manage by the executor of Groucho Marx's estate, who also was the chairman of Columbia Records.
Right.
And Teddy had a number one record. And he called me up and he said, I want you to go down there and manage him and protect my asset. This guy could be really big. But if the wrong guy gets him, so I went down, and the show wasn't good. I didn't enjoy it. But I went backstage, and there were 20 Jewish managers, all the best in the business. So I never even got to see him. So the guy called me up and I said, listen, he'll be well taken care of. It's all cool. He said, no, I want you. You got to go back down and actually meet him. And, you know, if he says no, then it's a no. But so I go back down and I pull up to the apartment house and there's a white Rolls Royce with Teddy on the license plate parked in the front. It's an apartment house. And I get in the elevator, go to the penthouse, and this gorgeous girl in a negligee comes and opens the door. But I mean, like, maybe the most gorgeous woman I had ever seen in my life up to that point.
Wow.
And then he comes over, walking in the room, he's just big, beautiful, you know. I've never seen a sexier guy.
Because he's a big man, too, right?
Big man, yeah. I said, listen, I'm not going to waste your time. I thought he would throw me out of the house, which was what I wanted. I said, listen, I'm not going to waste your time. There are not a whole lot of things I know in life. There's one thing that I am really sure of. You do not have the chops to figure out which one of us Jews is lying to you. Because you got the best talkers in the world.
Right, yeah.
I said, so I'm not going to give you another one of those spiels. Here's what I can tell you. I can get higher than you. I fuck more beautiful women than you. And when you collapse and you got the cash from the show in your pocket, I will be there to get the cash out of your pocket to make sure it's there when you wake up. I said, so if you want to do it, meet me somewhere, bring your best shots, bring your best drugs, your women, mm-hmm. who's ever standing. You know, if you're standing, I'm the wrong guy for you. If I'm standing, it's beautiful. I thought he would say, are you out of your mind? Get out of here. He said, I like that. When are we meeting? So we actually met at a hotel in New York, and he collapsed on the third day. And
on the third day.
And I've managed him ever since. And I never tell that story until he wrote his autobiography.
Oh, okay.
And in his autobiography, which is right here, he actually tells the story.
Truly blessed. Teddy Pendergrass, you got it right up on the bookshelf over here.
I just got
up. Yeah, you know exactly where it is. Something tells me you know exactly where the quote is as well.
I wondered if he had a thing back here. But very funny. He says, I never thought of a little Jewish kid from Long Island would get higher than me. And he says it's the luckiest day of his life.
Oh, yeah. So when you're talking about, you know, you're mentioning, you know, you're one of the boys and you can get higher and all that stuff, but you mentioned how bad of a alcoholic Alice was. How did you...
Oh, here it is.
Oh, you got the quote. Yeah. Okay, here we go.
When the last one had gone, I packed the stack of business cards I left behind and tossed them in the trash. What I didn't know that night was that the only manager worth having, a gentleman named Shep Gordon, had taken one look at the line backstage, said a quick hello to me, then split. The fact that he was so laid back intrigued me. After talking to some CBS record executives who suggested I call Shep, I invited him to my apartment. We talked a little bit, then Shep came right to the point. No matter what I say to you, 99% of the people who do what I do are complete liars. And they're good at it, too, so there's nothing I can tell you that will help you make a decision. Okay, I said. I like what I was hearing, but Shep sounded so different. I was starting to suspect he was a little bit nuts. Plus, most of his expertise was in white rock acts. He had never handled an R&B singer before. Teddy, you come up to New York one weekend. We'll take a two-bedroom suite in a hotel. We'll get some women, some booze, and whatever else you want, and let's just party. And whoever stays up the longest, who's ever up first on Monday morning, wins. If you're still standing, I leave. If I'm still standing, I'm your manager. Deal. We didn't really totally seal it right then, but we agreed on enough major points that Shep left saying, all right, let's get the wheelbarrows because the money's going to be pouring in. Best of all, I lost a bet. Who'd imagine I'd be out-partied by a white boy from Oceanside, Long Island? But I was, and it was one of the best things that ever happened to me. We shook hands, and that's been our contract ever since.
That's great. That's great.
And for him to admit that is big.
Sure. So how do you approach Alice when you, like you mentioned, the 80s, he was so bad. And he had a big resurgence in the 80s with Poison and Trash and, you know, Raise Your Fist and Yell, and became kind of Alice Cooper, the guy. Yeah. I'm sure that you had a lot to do with that.
Yeah. I don't know if I, you know, I would say there's a guy named Bob Pfeiffer who really had the most to do with it. I think we were getting sort of desperate. It just wasn't working, and he was working at CBS Records, and he was passionate, and he felt he had a way to bring it back.
So he was an exec.
He was a record executive, an A&R guy, and he really took it by the hand, and Poison, which was a hugely important record analysis career because it made him current again.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, even though there's a huge fan base that never liked that record, it really brought him back into a place where he could. He had enough of an audience that he could continue.
Once again, at my time, I was probably 18. That made Alice hot.
Yeah.
You know, he's on the charts.
Made him really contemporary.
Yeah. Exactly. Wasn't just a guy from the 70s. Much like Kiss in the 80s,
yeah,
did the same thing.
Absolutely.
Kiss and Alice, a lot of similarities,
yeah,
in their careers.
Yeah.
You know, so Bob, so are you saying Alice, you got to sober up? Is that when he got sober around that time frame?
I don't remember, timelines are tough, mm-hmm, for me. Mm-hmm. I know that he went to rehab, which didn't interfere with the career. Mm-hmm. We timed it so it didn't quite interfere. He came out of rehab, and we sort of continued. Then he went in, he hit bottom, mm-hmm, started using some drugs, bad drugs. I ducked out for a couple of years. My office managed him. I didn't talk to him. I didn't see him.
Oh, really?
He's still officially
managed by you, but not really hands-on.
Yeah, I mean, Alice and I have the greatest relationship. We're so honest with each other.
Sure.
You know? So I just went up to his house and I said, listen, I'm not going to work like a dog to make you money to go kill yourself. Mm-hmm. You want to do it? Your choice. You want to kill yourself? You know my views, but I'm not going to help you. Mm-hmm. But I'm also not going to drop you off a cliff. So if you want to use the office, use the office, but I'm out. Mm-hmm. And he hit the bottom and called. And that time was sort of a rough resurgence, and I think that's maybe Poison came out of that. He had never performed sober, so we didn't know if he could or not. So I got him this little horrible movie in Spain to do for 4 weeks of work to see how he felt about working, and
what was
great.
It called?
Monster Dog.
Okay, I remember. Yeah.
Which they dubbed him in English with an Italian voice. I think that's when Bob came into the picture, mm-hmm, and really helped. He brought in a writer from Bon Jovi,
Desmond Childs,
who wrote Poison with him. Mm-hmm. And it was also a time when videos were important, and we shot some great videos. Mm-hmm. The Poison video was great.
Yeah.
It was a good time.
Kind of put
but there've been plenty. You know, I think every career there's so many, it's how you deal with the failures that are important to get you back to the wins.
That's longevity.
Yeah,
that's how you last for 30-40 years in this biz. Just kind
of
winding down here, I wanted to ask you. I've been meaning to ask you this for the last couple of days. On the wall in the other room, there's all the anthology Beatles, uh-huh, anthology records, and it says, you know, to Shep Gordon. What was your involvement with that?
I George Harrison lived here. I helped George out a little
lived
bit.
Lived here at your place?
No, he lived in Maui.
He loved ukuleles, by the way, right?
Ukuleles.
His favorite instrument, yeah.
So I got friendly with him, and there came a point in time. He called me up. He started with a phone call about Ravi Shankar. Mm-hmm. And he called me up, and he said, I'll leave out the accent because I do it so bad. But he said, do you think there's anybody who would do a Ravi Shankar box set? I don't know how much longer he's going to live, and I want to do this with him. And I said, well, Capitol will do anything you want. And he said, they won't do anything. They won't even release our records. I said, what? What are you talking about? And he said, yeah, we have some new stuff. I don't even think they'll release it. We haven't even talked to them because we don't even think they'll want to release it.
Some of the Beatles' new stuff.
Yeah, and I said, what do you have? And he said, well, they found this thing, Bird is Free, a John Lennon thing, and the anthology tapes. And I said, you're out of your mind. Are you kidding me? And at that point, one of my really good friends who I was godfather to his kids had just taken the job of chairman of EMI and had never been in the record business. So I said, are you out of your mind? You're the Beatles. He said, no, they don't care. I said, when was the last time you asked? I've never been to the office. Said, you've never been to Capitol Records.
Wow.
He said, no, we've never been. So I said, would you be willing to go? I give you my word. I won't ask you to go unless they commit to a Ravi Shankar box set. But you'll see, they'll do anything you want. So he said yes, and we flew to New York, met with them. We did the box set. I still get royalties, but we sell like maybe 3 a year.
Have the Ravi Shankar.
But out of it came this stuff.
Yeah.
So I woke up one morning. This is maybe 3 months after they committed to doing the Ravi Shankar box set, but we hadn't finished it. And I woke up one morning and I just said, you know, I think it's time for me to get out. I was managing maybe 20 artists and 100 chefs. And I said, I think it's time for me to go. So I called up Alice. I said, where are you? He said, I'm in L.A. I said, would you pick me up for lunch? Because I'm going to resign from everybody today except you. And I want to get really drunk. And I don't want to drive. And I had a restaurant called Carlos and Charlie's at the time. So he said, sure. And he came over to the office to get me. And I had resigned from everybody. Luther was a little upset. Everybody else was pretty happy for me.
And this is Luther Vandross and Blondie.
Whoever. Yeah. I didn't have Blondie. I think I had it separated from Blondie, but it was Kenny Loggins, maybe Rick James at the time, Gypsy Kings, a couple of African artists, King Sunny Ade, Magique Fashique, Pointer Sisters, Luther. A nice, really nice,
veritable list.
Yeah, nice roster.
A-list rockers.
And all the great chefs of the world.
Yeah, which is another whole thing.
So now I'm done. I'm leaving the office, and my secretary says, you got to take this call. And I said, I'm done. It's over. I'm done. We're closing the office. I'm going to Hawaii. It's done. She said, no, you got to. So anyway, it was George Harrison saying they all wanted to put out the anthology tapes. And did I think Capitol would take them? So I said, do I think they'll take them? Turns out they didn't want to take them.
They didn't want to take
it. It's a long story, but it.
Wow.
But I made it all work.
Right.
So, everything is humans and politics, as I'm sure you have learned along the way of your life.
Yeah.
And most of the people listening here, if they've been in the world of commerce, realize that reality doesn't always matter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's human business. The chairman of EMI at the time was a very nice man who I was very friendly with, Sir Colin Southgate. And he was a scientist who had, EMI was an electronics company who just happened to be in the music business. They had owned Capitol Records. But the main part of their company was Thorne EMI.
Right.
They made refrigerators and they were an electronics company. They made light bulbs and all that, like GE, sort of like a GE. So he got hired to be chairman of the company. He's a scientist. He's not a businessman. The week after he gets the job, Capitol Records tell him that they've re-signed the Beatles and that he needs to make an announcement to the, they call it, the Wall Street there is called the Street. So he holds his first press conference as chairman of EMI and announces that they've re-signed the Beatles. And during the press conference, he gets served by a lawsuit from the Beatles. So his attitude was... I don't want the Beatles.
That's right.
Let the Beatles go. Right. Exactly. The Beatles.
Right.
So it was a complicated negotiation.
But you made it happen.
Made it happen.
And those albums are classic ones, right?
Classic, yeah.
Did you ever have any dealings with the three of them at all, like phone calls or anything like that?
I don't think I ever had the three of them in a room.
Hmm.
Paul always sent his lawyer. Ringo I knew fairly well. Ringo
was a Hollywood vampire too, wasn't he?
He was a Hollywood vampire, but he also went from here to rehab, him and Barbara. So I helped sort of expedite it.
Right.
Yeah. They were here and the light went on that they were drunks and they really needed to change their life. And so they left from here to rehab.
Hmm.
So I was, and George I knew well. The guy who really ran it was a guy named Neil Aspinall.
Yeah.
He was the one that really...
He'd been with the Beatles since the 60s.
Yeah, he was the road manager.
Yeah, right. So, Shep, you mentioned, everyone says, your book is called They Call Me Superman. The book is Superman. And I have to ask you this, being in show business for as long as you have, how are you so nice? Because that's the thing, you really are like the nicest guy in the world. Like, we've had the best time here. You invited my family to come stay with you after knowing you for those 2 hours. You've had all these great people come by. Everyone I mentioned, whether it's Sammy Hagar or Paul Stanley or whoever, Shep is the best guy. He's so nice over the best time. How do you stay so nice?
It's just how I am. I have no idea. And by the way, your family is unbelievably nice.
Oh, thank you.
I hope that doesn't ruin your image.
No. The rocker, come on, man.
Yeah. His kids are amazing.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Wife and kids, it's been a pleasure to have you here. I mean, for me, again, it's really selfish. I live sort of alone. I'm not married anymore. None of my kids live with me. Three of them have come back of my adopted kids in the last few years.
Great,
so I get them around. But they just came back. And it's great. I get to meet interesting people in a relaxed atmosphere. I get something from it. It's been great to meet you. I'm a wrestling fan my whole life. Mm-hmm. So to see behind the curtain, you know, and most of the people who come through the house or that I deal with have accomplished something in their lives. You know, and it's so great to see that journey and share that stuff. I feel very, really privileged.
And, interesting
and
story.
I've never felt like ownership is a healthy thing. So for me, I've always felt like the steward of this property, not the owner, which makes it really important to sort of share it and let people use it. And, you know, I think here in Hawaii, they really think of they call it the mana, which is the spirit of your land. And they deal with it like another person, the mana of your land. Mm-hmm. So for me, it really helps the house. It's just, again, it's so selfish. You know, we've had great dinners the last two nights. It's been so much fun. Yeah. His kid caught a...
Yeah, my son Ash.
Caught a fish that was taller than him.
Yeah.
That we've cooked for, we've eaten the last 2 days.
There's an Ono.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
It was great. So that was exciting.
You said it was one of the best fish you've ever had in your life.
No, to see your girls enjoying it so much. It's so great.
Yeah.
You know. So to have a little oasis of sanity somewhere in the world, you know, where you know your kids are safe, your thoughts are safe, you can be whoever you are, you know.
It's a good way to be. Like I said, it's very contagious and infectious as well.
Yeah. And important to pass it on. And I'm sure, you know, the kids, I've now had kids who are 25, 30 years that have been coming here. And I can see that it sort of affects the way they treat their homes and their friends and stuff. You know, they talk about it to me that, you know, oh, man, I did a party last week. Just like you, I had 30 people over. Everybody cooked. And
well, see, this thing. We live in Florida on a lake. And we have, you know, right there, tubing and water skiing, all that sort of stuff. And we have parties at our place all the time, too, for the same reason.
I could see your kids are very comfortable in company.
Thank you. And why not, if you have a nice place, why not share that with people and have
important.
Everyone come over?
Yeah,
be,
no.
Come
I
in
mean,
wherever
I,
you want.
I think the world, this sounds very simplistic, but that's the place where the world's problems have to be solved, is right there, you know, in your home. And put out kids that are happy and willing to share and not, you know, not hoarding.
Right, right, not guarding it. Last question, who's your favorite bands?
Harold Melvin and the Blue Note was one of my favorites. I didn't know Teddy was in it.
Wow.
The Who I love.
Yeah.
Rolling Stones, unbelievable. Beatles, of course.
Obviously.
I would say, as an off-the-wall, Leo Sayer is probably who I listen to in my car more than anybody else. I love those Richard Perry records.
Wow. Okay.
And I can sing with them. I'm a horrible singer. But in the car by myself, I love singing with Leo Sayer.
Everyone's a great singer when they're in the car by themselves.
I would say those. I never was a hard rock guy, even though I was with Alice. But I like it all. But I would say if you had to give me like two or three records to listen to, it would be Leo Sayer, probably Rolling Stones, and Teddy.
Teddy, yeah.
Would be my
to this day.
Yeah.
Shep, thank you, man.
Thank you.
You definitely are the super mensch. I want to be the junior mensch.
Thank you. Nice, great joy to meet you, man.
Thank you, man. Me too. Me too.
Wrestled so many times.
Thank you. He really is a super mensch, the nicest guy, not even the nicest in the entertainment business, one of the nicest guys I've ever met in my life, period. Shep Gordon. His autobiography, They Call Me Super Mensch, just came out this week. So many great rock and roll stories, celebrity chef stories, just stories of being around the royalty of Hollywood for 50 years. He told some great stories on this show today. I love the John and Yoko stuff. I mean, just a couple of just weird cats, but that barely scratched the surface of his incredible career. You're going to want to pick up his book. You can go to supermensch.com, and of course, you can get it on Amazon as well. You can also get Shep's documentary, Supermensch, The Legend of Shep Gordon, directed by Mike Myers. That's on Amazon too. And if you do, please use the Talk is Jericho Amazon links to make your purchase. You can support your favorite podcast and the great Shep Gordon, my good friend, in one easy click. Okay. Remember, the Amazon links are at podcastone.com. Click on the killer deals button in the top right corner of the page, then hit the Talk is Jericho button. Amazon links in the USA, the UK, the Canada. Every time you use them links, Amazon kicks back a small percentage to the show to help us cover production costs. Remember, there's no hidden fees or extra charges. Once again, go to podcastone.com, click on the killer deals button in the top right corner of the page, then hit Talk is Jericho. You'll find all my other great sponsors there as well. ddpyoga.com/Jericho. Get 20% off the DDP Yoga program, plus 3 months full access to the DDP Now app. Then there's DraftKings. Use my promo code Y2J to play for free with no deposit this weekend. Then Jack Threads as well. Go to jackthreads.com. Enter my promo code Jericho when you submit your trial and get 20% off anything you keep. It's a big thanks to all of you for checking out the Jericho Network as well on Podcast One. We're doing our best to keep you entertained. Keep it at 100 with Conan. Huge hit on Thursdays. Team Tiger Awesome. Hilarious every Sunday. This one coming up, no exception. They're talking beef buddies and sharing stories about the times they literally wanted to kick their own asses. That's up right now. We actually just did one, I think it's going to be on Sunday, where we create our own wrestling characters. I guest star coming up this Sunday on Team Tiger Awesome. Chris Jericho is there to talk about wrestling. Isn't that what you guys always want me to talk about? Well, you get me making my fantasy wrestling character, or is he a fantasy wrestling character? I guarantee you're going to love it. That's this Sunday on the Team Tiger Awesome Show on the Jericho Network via Podcast One. Got another big show getting ready to announce in a couple days. In the meantime and in between time, leave everyone 5-star ratings and reviews. You won't be disappointed. Don't forget, also March 15th, 2017, the biggest podcast ever. When Mick Foley joins Talk is Jericho, the countdown rolls on. 174 days to go. So thank you for listening. Keep listening for the 60-second AP News headlines coming up next. And this next Wednesday, see you next Wednesday when our guest is going to be the amazing and very, very funny Ron Funches. He did the show a few months ago, waiting for the right time to put him on. He is, he's basically almost like a wrestling comedian. He knows everything about wrestling. Very, very funny. Like 18-time Midnight Champ on Comedy Central. You're going to love him. You're going to laugh. He's a great, great guy. Great, great guest. Ron Funches will be here on Wednesday. I will be here on Wednesday, and hopefully you'll be here on Wednesday too. See you then. Peace, love, and hugs, and a big yeah, boy. Have a safe weekend.
You can download new episodes of Talk is Jericho every Wednesday and Friday at podcastone.com. That's podcastone.com.